I think we are beginning to record, and I thought that this week, since last week, was I here last week? Yes. It's my second week, I think, after the retreat in Norway. And last week was actually Uposatha. It was the full moon day, I think. And it was a very special full moon day because it was the first full moon of May, which is usually the Buddha's birthday, enlightenment day, and Parinibbana day. Although in this month there are actually two full moons, so we can take our pick. I don't know, a lot of Buddhist communities and countries have already celebrated the Vesak, but it's becoming a bit of a Vesak month, I think, this year. And we have ours right at the end of the month. Anyway, so last week we talked about the Uposatha Sutta, very relevant, and it is from the Anguttara Nikaya number 3, verse 70, the Book of the Threes, verse 70. And I'm guessing that the reason it's the Book of the Threes is that the Buddha's talking about three kinds of Uposatha. And for the sake of anyone who wasn't here last week, I will just recap very briefly on those three, because it's really quite amusing. So the Buddha basically says to Visakha, who is a very famous Buddhist lay woman, who was one of the great supporters of the Buddha in his lifetime and of the whole Sangha, actually, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and herself became at least a stream winner, I think perhaps more than that, I forget. And she comes to the Buddha and tells him that she's observing the Uposatha. And he gives a teaching saying that there are three kinds of Uposathas: the cowherd's Uposatha, the Niganta's Uposatha, and the noble one's Uposatha. I remembered that it wasn't the Buddhist Uposatha, because guess what? The Buddha never referred to his teachings as being any religion. It's okay to call it Buddhism nowadays for conventional purposes, but of course the Buddha was teaching the Dhamma, and the Dhamma that led to one becoming a noble person. So it was actually, and still is, appropriate for people of any religion, in the sense that as long as you are practicing and come to understand right view, you're going to get enlightened. You're going to be free from suffering, whatever you call yourself. And the cowherd's Uposatha, I won't read it, but it's really quite funny. Basically, it's people who sit around all day and think about the food that they've eaten, or the food that they are going to eat, or the food that they wish they could eat, or the food they ate in the past or could eat in the future. So on these moon days, please don't think that way, because the Buddha would tell you that you're observing the Uposatha like a cowherd. So they pass the day with greed and longing in their mind. And because of that, it is not of great fruit and benefit, nor is it extraordinarily brilliant and pervasive. Okay, so he's not saying you're a bad, stupid person, but he is saying that you won't get great fruit and benefit, which is really pointing towards the benefits that are possible through practicing the Dhamma properly, right? Great fruits and benefits, actual freedom from that longing and that craving, not craving and greed themselves. And then there is the Nigantas Uposatha, and the Nigantas were the Jains, a contemporary religion in the Buddha's time, and they had probably almost as many disciples as the Buddha. And in this case, the problem is that they spread loving kindness and compassion in various directions, but only so far, and not to all living beings in every direction. And the other thing they do is they say, oh, I am not anywhere the belonging of anyone, and nor is there anything anywhere in any place that is mine. However, the parents know this is our son, and they know these are my parents. And their partners and children know this person is our supporter, and they know these are my partners and children. This is my partner and children. In other words, they are saying one thing and practicing in a completely different way. So their practice doesn't have integrity. It's only theoretical knowledge, theoretical understanding, but it's actually, they're still full of limited loving kindness, if you can be full of that. And they still are very clingy to the people they live with and consider them theirs. Okay, so these are the two types of upasata. They're not of great fruit and benefit, nor are they extraordinarily brilliant and pervasive. And then we got on to the noble ones of upasata, and we only got halfway at best. So last week we talked about the first three reflections that we can do to make the upasata truly beneficial. The first was reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha. And these are the famous chantings that we do in monasteries. Itipiso, Bhagava, Arahan, Samma, Sambuddho. And then also reflecting on the Dhamma, reflecting on the Sangha. So the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha is known as the Triple Gem. And by reflecting on them, our minds become enlightened. Inspired, maybe enlightened eventually. Oh, that would be great. But they become inspired and uplifted. And the Buddha actually says then the mind becomes placid. That really means peaceful and calm, just like Richard's meditation. And joy arises. And the defilements of the mind are abandoned in the same way that a dirty cloth is cleansed by exertion. So this is by reflecting skillfully on those qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. And I think last week we talked about many other qualities that are not maybe directly included in the list, but things that really inspire us. And I think it's really important to find our own relationship to these teachings, right? And think about them carefully. You know, how has the Buddha's teaching affected your life? How has the Buddha's example affected your life? Can you reflect on how it might feel to be in his presence, to be regarded with such immense compassion and complete non-judgment? You know, how has the Dhamma helped you in your life? How have the great monastics, bhikkhunis and bhikkhus, or anyone else who's practicing well, how have they inspired you, encouraged you, supported you, tried to uplift you when you're down? You know, shown you qualities that they've cultivated and that they're telling you you can cultivate too. Shown you your own potential. These are all qualities of true friends, true spiritual friends. Yeah, and the Buddha says that such friends are the whole of the holy life, the whole of the spiritual path. And it's important to choose people carefully as our teachers, right? We're not looking for perfection. You'll never find perfection. Even in the Buddha's day, he wasn't perfect enough for people. He was perfect in the sense that he had no more greed, hate and delusion, but not everybody was pleased with the Buddha. Some people thought he should be vegetarian. Some people thought that he should, I don't know, ordain them sooner. Or some people, yeah, were probably quite upset when he told them not to argue or tried to correct their view, and they insisted that their view was correct. And that they wanted to continue arguing, you know. And then the Buddha sometimes would walk away and say, there's nothing I can do in this case when people aren't open to hearing the teachings. Sometimes the Buddha had to ask people to leave the monastery. There's one passage where he asks his left-hand monk, the monk who's foremost in psychic powers, to go and remove somebody. And he actually removes them physically from the assembly because they're having such unwholesome thoughts. So, reflecting in these ways is going to bring our mind a lot of joy and help us to abandon some of our defilements. So now we get on to the next part of the sutta. And these are also really beautiful practices. So this is the fourth one, okay? So under the Noble Upasata, we have reflecting on the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and then we come to the next. Maybe I should just pause first of all to see if there are any questions or comments before we continue. Anything unclear, especially if it's your first time, you missed last week's. Yeah, we carry on. All right, so, and also for anyone here at all, please raise your virtual hand at any time. Or write in the chat at any time if you have a question or comment, and I'll come to you when it's a proper moment to come to you, okay? So here we go. We're on page 297 now of the Anguttara Nikaya from Bhikkhu Bodhi, and again, it's from the Anguttara 3s, verse 70. But don't worry if you don't have the book. So the Buddha goes on to the next one. The defiled mind, Visakha, that's the laywoman, is cleansed by exertion. And how is the defiled mind, or the mind with greed, hate and delusion, cleansed by exertion? Here, Visakha, a noble disciple reflects on their own, recollects their own virtuous behaviour as unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, and leading to stillness. The word is samadhi, which is often translated as concentration. Seems strange, doesn't it, when your mind is all free and happy and light and then you concentrate. So I prefer stillness, or even absorption, or serenity you could have as well. When a noble disciple recollects their virtuous behaviour, their mind becomes placid, joy arises, and defilements of the mind are abandoned, in the same way that a dirty mirror is cleansed by exertion. And how, Visakha, is a dirty mirror cleansed by exertion? By means of oil, ashes, a roll of cloth, and the appropriate effort by the person. It is in such a way that a dirty mirror is cleansed by exertion. In other words, you need the cleaning apparatus, oil, ashes, and cloth. Nowadays we use vinegar and newspaper, usually. That's quite a good method. And although you have to put water on before the vinegar, otherwise sometimes they're so dirty you just get smudges. And the appropriate effort by the person. So you have to know what you're doing it for. What are you cleaning and why? And how much effort do you need? And how do you know when it's clean? Right? If you only do it for like 2 minutes, it might not work. Or if you do it in a way that, you know, isn't particularly sincere, perhaps, or you start thinking of all the things you actually did wrong, then it won't really work. So, and then it's repeated. So here, a noble disciple recollects their own virtuous behaviour as unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped and leading to stillness. And then mind becomes placid, joy arises, and the defilements of the mind are abandoned, in the same way that a dirty mirror is cleansed by exertion. This is called a noble disciple who observes the apostate of virtuous behaviour, who dwells together with virtuous behaviour. And it is by considering virtuous behaviour that their mind becomes placid, joy arises, and the defilements of the mind are abandoned. It is in this way that the defiled mind is cleansed by exertion. Okay, so this is something, and a very important practice that I could really give a whole talk on, because it's such a beautiful and counterintuitive practice, I think, especially for people raised in kind of cultures where we're praised for being critical, right? And we're encouraged to be critical and to constantly improve, to see our faults. If you see your faults, then that means you're, you know, very humble and you've got scope for improvement. I mean, to some extent, that might be true. And on the other hand, we might know that it's good to be virtuous, but we don't think it's particularly wholesome, perhaps, or maybe we worry that it's going to lead to some kind of egotism to actually think about all the good things we've done afterwards. How many people here actually reflect on the good things that they've done during a day or during... Okay, that's not bad, actually. About 4 or 5, some of you are like, sort of. I actually have to confess that I'm sort of. I mean, I do, but not as much as I should. And I remember saying this to Venerable Upekkha, and she said, "What? With all the service you're giving, you're wasting it. You're wasting it," she said. And I realised that's quite an important practice. Ajahn Brahm also used this practice a lot in the early years of building his monastery, because he didn't have a lot of time for meditation. And it would have taken much longer than in the past when he had a lot of hours to get the joy coming up in the mind. And so by reflecting on the good things he'd done that day and the meaning of the things that he'd done that day, which was sometimes, you know, laying bricks. I mean, is laying bricks particularly ethical? It is when you know that you're creating a monastery and that people are going to come and meditate there, and people you don't even know, and you're doing it out of selflessness without any vested interest. But you just have this faith that this is a good thing to do. And just how incredible that is. And perhaps he would then think about people who built monasteries that he'd meditated in and how he was now being able to, you know, pay it forward, etc., etc. Today I was helped by Nat and Seminary Upachala to plant some trees, in fact, three more trees. And I think maybe Manoi might laugh because actually you look quite encouraging because you're not laughing. But yes, there's something deep to that. It's not just that I love trees and get an enormous amount of joy and love and kindness coming up towards trees. It's the fact that they're being planted in a monastery called a grove, by the way, Anukampa Grove. And these trees will grow and provide shade for people who stay. I can imagine Dhamma conversations happening around these trees. I can imagine people having their lunch quietly under these trees, contemplating nature, recognizing impermanence. And not only that, but the birds and the pollinators and all the other animals and creatures and insects that will eat the berries, eat the fruits. And the place will be really a sanctuary, a nature sanctuary, not just a big piece of lawn. So it can be really beautiful to reflect in this way, because sometimes we do things and we know they're good, but we don't really take the time to really soak in the benefit. And I love the questions that are coming up now because these are common questions, so I get to speak to this. But in short, it does not create more of a sense of self, because you're reflecting on actions and their consequences. In other words, cause and effect. When I act with loving kindness, people around me gain trust, people relax, people are friendly, even animals are drawn to me. And that's a wonderful gift that I can offer to other beings. I also feel better in myself. I'm less likely to be irritable, for example. So isn't it wonderful that I've been practicing loving kindness? That doesn't enhance the ego. That encourages you to practice more loving kindness because it's good for you and it's good for others. So remember, this is about virtue. Even if you would feel proud of being virtuous, I mean, let it be, you know. We can be proud about a lot worse, right? So, I mean, it's a stepping stone. And of course, as long as there's a sense of self, it may sometimes cling to these things. But I'm going to read some of the comments and then we'll have a bit more discussion about this. I also would love to get into some of these, the descriptions about virtuous behaviour and how we can reflect on it ourselves. So, okay. Someone said, it was very hard the first time I tried this. I thought I was rubbish. Oh, that was a long time ago. And this is the thing, it's not about I am rubbish or good, it's about the action. It's not about a person who's doing the action, it's about the action itself. Yeah, there's a lovely passage in the Visuddhimagga that says something like, thoughts are, but no thinker of the thoughts is there. Deeds are, but no doer of the deeds exists. And then the really beautiful one, there might be a bit more to it. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. Oh no, the path is, but not the person who walks on it, something like that. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it, something like that. And that's actually very profound. That's very profound. That's it. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters. Yeah. I had that written on a little stone once, a beautiful pebble. And I found it very inspiring. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. So if you're still travelling, if there's still a sense I'm doing this, then the path is yet to come to fulfillment. But of course, we have that in the beginning. OK. Okay, I'm not going to continue with the comments. I also find it really powerful to mix the virtue recollection with the aspirational prayer that it may really be of benefit to all beings. This is something I learned from Tibetan teachers. Yeah, that's lovely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's slightly different. It's kind of two practices, but I don't see why you can't mix things that work for you, you know. It really is fun when we start to experiment in these ways and find what actually works for us. We can be so imaginative with these things because they're really for the purpose of rousing joy and inspiration. They're, in a way, using skillful perception to support your meditation. So it doesn't have to be true even, right? You don't know that your virtue is going to help others. It doesn't really matter. The point is, like the Buddha says, that the mind becomes still, peaceful, joy arises, and the defilements are cleansed. So if we see that's happening, great. So yeah, that's something else I do as well at the end of every meditation, is to share the benefits out of loving kindness for all beings. Yeah. But I like that, yeah, praying that your virtue will be of benefit, really be of benefit to all beings. And it actually will, whether you know it or not. I mean, you know what it's like if there's someone who's not virtuous, the troubles it can create. I was just giving an example of some things that have even happened in monasteries where somebody's behaviour was like not particularly, they were lacking integrity, shall we say. They were lacking the right motivation. And because of that, the whole community fell apart. You know, so sometimes we don't stop to think about all the stuff we could have done that we didn't do. All the bad things we could have done that we didn't do, and that's wonderful. And even if your virtue wasn't perfect in every aspect, it was good in some. So think about that, bring it up. And you're all lay people here, I think. I don't think seminary sopas here today. So you definitely have livelihoods, and I'm sure you're doing something in your livelihood that's helping others. Even if you're not working, you know, then you're looking after yourself, I hope, or you're, you know, maybe doing some volunteer work or at least practicing, listening to Dhamma. So the next question, which I've already spoken to a little bit, doesn't it create more of the ego by reflecting on the good things done? No. It undermines it because you're reflecting on cause and effect, as I said. Like, now there's a me who's done something good for others. Nah, not really. I find myself being trapped in this kind of thinking, especially when I'm praised a lot. Yeah, that's more about praise and blame, which are actually really tricky to deal with. It might be good if you're being praised for something and you know that the ego is coming up in response to that, not to use that as something to reflect on, because you know there's a danger with that particular thing. But I think the fact that you're aware of it is already very positive. And yeah, I mean, as I say, be a bit easy on yourself, because unless you're a stream winner, the sense of self will be there. Even for a stream winner, it is there sometimes. I mean, not the view of self, but still they sometimes have thoughts and perceptions of self. That's why they still aren't completely liberated. So go easy on yourself. It's still so important to do good. And maybe if you just think about the benefits of doing good and how it makes you feel, how it makes others feel in particular, then you can, you know, get it in context. It's not about you being a good person. It's about the effect it's having on others. So maybe shift to that perspective. There's a lot of questions in the chat. Would anyone like to speak from the chat who hasn't raised their hands? Because otherwise it's just me speaking. It's quite tiring, I have to say, on my voice, and I think it's lovely to hear other voices. If anyone who has written a comment in the chat would like to speak, I'll come to you first. No one with their hand up. Maybe Mel? I don't know.
Hi, Venerable. I'm very happy to give your voice a break.
Excellent. That's very
Please have some tea.
Oh, yeah, great idea. I have hot water.
Oh, perfect. Thank you for this. This has been so helpful because I work with people in recovery from addiction, and I get them to do exactly this, you know, sort of reflect at the end of each day, the things that are going well and right, and also what they've done well, because most people think that they haven't done anything well because their self-esteem is so bad. And I've been asked, well, isn't that selfish? Isn't that feeding my ego? So to have the response of cause and effect, and just that, I mean, I know neuroscience says, you know, if we dwell on something for 3 to 5 seconds, it starts to change the synapses in our brain, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
But it's just lovely that this comes from this sutta. And in my own personal experience, it's been absolutely transformative.
Fantastic.
Really. Yeah. Aww. So I just wanted to share that and give you a break.
Thank you so much. And it's so much richer than reading the message, although the message is great, but that really brought it to life, thinking about how that could help people in recovery. Wonderful. I'll come to Shirley. I'm coming to you, Joseph, but I'm just going to the people who've had their questions in the chat for longer.
Well, like Mel, I thought I'd give your voice a rest. I often talk too much, so that's why I wrote something in the chat. Thank Mel for her beautiful comment. I think that's really lovely. But I sometimes use the Salaka Sutta when this is others will harm, I will not harm here, or we will not harm here.
Yes.
As a sort of, when I get really oppressed by the horrors that are going on in the world and I just feel overwhelmed and I think this is something I can, you know, this is something I can contribute, I think somebody once said if everybody just kept the first precept for one day, even just regarding humans, the whole world would be transformed. It would be fantastic if there was no killing. And, you know, I don't go around killing people or animals. And other people are, and I can just sort of think to myself, yeah, I'm not going to do that. I don't go down that way. And that brings a sense of peace sometimes. But it also brings this rather, not so much ego, but this insidious sense of I'm on the right. I'm one of the good guys, us and them. And how to come to that. So that's
super. Yeah, thanks for that. And I just read the comment in the chat. And I think that it's a very similar thing, you know. I love that you brought that sutta in because I'm actually planning to bring that exact quote into a talk I'm giving to Sydney, the Sydney group, about how to deal with the things that are happening in the world. And that's one of the ways, you know, to actually learn what not to do from the behaviours that we see. And I think to avoid the us and them thing is, again, to see how actions have results. So you can see what happens, for example, when you have political leaders who become divisive and who establish entire political systems around fear-mongering and, you know, exploiting and marginalising the vulnerable and just exploiting the world's resources and particularly being divisive, right? And so we can say, OK, this really has obviously bad consequences and sort of brings out all kind of fears in people and makes it unsafe for people. So let me not do that. You know, it's even more important in the light of things like that happening that we're even more proactive in actually reaching out to others. It's not enough even just not to do that, but can we actually do the opposite and counter it? So I think see it in terms of like, okay, there's this much sort of energy in that direction. Let me put more energy in this direction instead. So I think, again, just to see where things are imbalanced and to try to kind of counter that and give the opposite message. You know, like at this time, there's racism is starting to become kind of not exactly normalized, but yeah, it's pretty scary, right? And so maybe checking in on our friends of color or, you know, trying to read about other people's cultures and try and understand how it might feel for them or whatever else it might be, try and do the opposite. So yeah, the us and them, again, we still have a sense of self, it's going to happen, but that doesn't mean it's not still good to do the practice. And a lot of the practice is noticing how and why and when these defilements arise, right? How and when we go from a virtuous state of mind to something that's like still well-intentioned, but the sense of self is coming in. So I think just be very open to that and don't stop because of that. You know, just see it and, okay, so this is arising. I'm not going to buy into that. I'm just going to try to, you know, get in touch with the more selfless aspect of why I'm doing this. Remember why you're doing it. That's important, I think. There's no path that someone walks, the path walks us. Yeah, that's nice. Okay, now I will come to Joseph. No, on mute. Ah, there we go.
Thank you for your patience and sharing. I was thinking about if it's possible to combine all six recollections into like one loving kindness meditation, and that would be super meritorious. There's one particular passage in the Great Assembly Sutta where there are a type of deva called the Metta Karuna Kaika devas, which are the embodiments of love and care. Devas who embody love and care, they go to rejoice in the mendicant Sangha in the woods. And I was thinking about how that one passage incorporates the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Sila, generosity, and devas all in one.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of a wholesome perception of the breath to encourage recollection of the breath and this idea of embodying love and care. And I was thinking about how with every exhale, we release carbon dioxide, which nourishes the plants, and then the plants release oxygen. And so with every breath we take, it's a gift from every other breathing thing. And with every exhale, we are providing nourishment for all other breathing things on the planet. And so if every arahant can only be reborn as a human, can only attain arahantship as a human, then every arahant on the planet, where with every breath we are contributing to their health and happiness with every breath. So human beings are embodiments of love and care because our most intimate form of, we can fast for days, we can't fast with our breath. And so when we nourish the Sangha with every breath that we take, and every in-breath is a gift and every exhale is an offering. And so I was thinking about if maybe I could request like a loving kindness meditation for the benefit of all beings that incorporates all six recollections for our health and happiness.
Maybe you should do one, Joseph, in your place, because you know what's really important, I think, with teaching the Dhamma is we teach what we practice. For me, that's what I do. I teach what I practice. So I can consider it. But unless I'm practicing that, I'm probably going to, you know, teach something that I've been practicing myself. But yeah, I mean, this is an example of being creative, right? And bringing these recollections together, if that's what works for you. And for myself, I would probably keep it quite simple when it comes to something like recollecting the my own virtuous behavior. But I would use perceptions as and when I see fit. I think the recollection of Sila is kind of in itself a practice. And breath practices that use metta meditation are maybe more on the metta side, which is fine. But I think it's really worth practicing, just as the Buddha says, you know, recollect that virtue that is unbroken, that is flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise. All of these kind of recollections about virtue also help us to gain a lot of insight into virtue itself, right? And into our particular ways that we behave. So I would just encourage to really like investigate that as a practice in and of itself, as well as combining. That might be good. All right. So I'm coming to a comment in the chat again. I once went to Jamyang in London to talk to the monk in charge about your daily practice and expressed joy in trying to practice loving kindness. And you noticed how people seemed to relax around you and everything seemed more peaceful. Oh. Unfortunately, the monk banned you from going there again. Oh, that's a shame. Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess this sometimes happens, but as long as you don't hold ill will in your heart, right? And you recognize maybe this person has their own troubles or their own, I don't know, reasons that maybe you can never understand, then that's the most important thing. So maybe just, you said you went with the best intentions. So, yeah, maybe just see if you can keep good intentions in mind for that person, because we never really know. You can't predict sometimes the way people behave. Oh, dear. Okay, Ian Alicia.
Hi.
Hi.
I'll see if I can, hopefully I can articulate this the way that it's in my head somewhat. I really appreciated what I believe Mel, I think, was saying earlier, and kind of going off of that, something I'd been thinking about, which is like if you're going through kind of a dip in practice, or maybe even to some degree, not like anything traumatic, but just in virtue because of like mental illness or stress or mm-hmm. something,
something
kind of falling apart. I'm just wondering if you have any kind of advice.
Yeah.
I really liked the gratitude thing, but like if there's anything else, or, you know, and also reflecting on like, what did I do well today? Because I think that's something I've been kind of trying to bring in. But if there's anything else kind of going off of that, like how do you kind of recover and also like treat yourself with kindness during that time? Because I feel like it can be really hard to sort of feel like there's anything good to look at. And you're just like, oh, I've failed. I've earned this.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've all been there, you know, or if not now, it may come upon us. And maybe at times like that, I mean, obviously, to try to reflect on what you have done well or what you haven't done that you could have done that would have been bad, you know, because basically your character has probably not changed that much. And considering that you're depressed, considering that you're struggling for whatever reason at that time, actually, any amount of CELO is really commendable, even more commendable, right? I often say that that's when you really see a person's character. If you can actually remain pretty good during that time, and also forgive yourself if you go off at someone or if you just can't really give very much, then just forgive yourself for that, because the challenges you're dealing with at that time are much more than other people are dealing with. So that's why we can never judge another person. But another thing that came to mind actually is that perhaps when the thoughts are more intrusive and more believable, it might be better to do a more active practice, such as writing things down, like actually write a kind of monologue or list a number of things that have gone well or that you've done well or that you have done in the past, your general qualities, what other people say about you, for example, and really just list it so that your mind can't sabotage it as easily because you're actively engaged in the process. That might be helpful as well. And then I also think, you know, sometimes it's not enough to practice the Dhamma alone. Sometimes part of, maybe we can say, practicing the Dhamma is to accept that there might be physiological causes for something like depression or physical causes. I mean, it's physiological, neurochemical imbalances. And sometimes give yourself, you know, the chance to take some medication or to talk to a counsellor or something like this. Because sometimes we can get really stuck in negative loops, and also the mood can just be low because the chemical imbalance is happening in the brain. So to keep that perspective, you know, you don't have to do it all through the way you use your mind and through your practice, because that's really tricky. I studied Indian medicine for 3 years in the gap between living in India and trying to find somewhere to ordain. Well, actually, I was already trying for about 7 years and there was nowhere. So then I had the chance to study Indian medicine. And the theory there, or the philosophy really, the whole purpose of it, was to get so much balance in the body and mind, and with use of things like the senses. So in other words, sense restraint and uplifting the senses and virtue and all of that, before we even start to pursue a higher spiritual path. So sometimes we can, you know, it's not that it's linear, but we can go back to another part of the path and just get some adjustment there. But yeah, maybe be more proactive, particularly imaginative, asking other people, you know, if you can't think for yourself. And yeah, really try and encourage yourself through that time. I hope that's helpful, but come back if there's anything else. Come back, we can come back to it. Kedwin, lots of questions now. We'll try and get on to the next one as well, but we'll see how we go, because this is a really important one, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Venerable. This is really so helpful. I feel like I'm going to have to come back and watch this recording 100 times. I just want to say how much I value the monastics that are continuing to be online, and especially now that I'm in Albania, where I feel like I'm maybe the only Buddhist in the entire country. Everybody's Muslim or Orthodox Christian, which is fine. They're very wonderful people, but
yeah,
but it's hard. It feels a little bit isolating.
Yeah, of course.
So I was thinking, you know, I said when you asked, we were doing this practice, and I was like, yeah, I used to do this every single day, and it was assigned to me by a lay teacher about 20 years ago, and I felt like that. So the assignment was to write 5 gratitudes, 5 virtuous behaviors, and 5 virtuous behaviors of others, and this helped me so much. And I was curious what you thought about it, because the writing the virtuous behaviors that I noticed in others really helped my mindset. And I thought, I mean, I'm so glad we're talking about this, because I'm putting it back on my list of what I'm going to do today.
Fantastic.
I need brightness in my practice again. And this just feels like, I mean, it's really what changed. A lot of people here know that I grew up in kind of difficult circumstances. And so I had a very like negative mindset, and doing this practice really changed that for me.
Wonderful. And
looking for like, oh, look at that person just, you know, did that thing for that person on the street. And
fantastic.
Really sweet.
Yeah, I think that's so, so important. I mean, one thing is you mentioned your more difficult background, but also in times when we just hear all the bad stuff that people do, because you never hear all what somebody did in the street on the news, really, except if it's shocking. And the reason it's on the news and gets publicity is because it's not normal, actually. It's an anomaly, and it's when human nature goes kind of wrong that it gets into the news, you know? So I think that's wonderful. I mean, the more we reflect in this way, the more of a habit it becomes. And that's what the Buddha said, but that's also what neuroscience is proving, you know, that the more we kind of dwell in the goodness of ourselves or of others, or, you know, the things we're grateful for, the more that just sets off really good chemicals in the brain and actually creates new neural pathways. So it becomes easier and easier and easier over time. But it's like a muscle, right? Any muscle that we want to be strong, we have to keep on using that muscle. Otherwise, we slip back into the old ways. But that's the amazing thing about the fact that the mind is conditioned. We can recondition it at any time. So if you need more brightness, go for it and do it in any way that feels right for you. I think it's very immediate and very easy, isn't it, to have like a little system going where it's like 5 things that I can't remember what you said, of like your own virtue maybe, or 5 things that other people have done that was beautiful, virtuous, and 5 things that you're grateful for. That's one example, but find your own, everybody here. And maybe you can have a little book where that's at the top, and then you just write on it every day, and it becomes easy to organize. I know someone else here who loves numbers, and I think, you know, if that's the way your mind works, it's great. I could imagine enjoying that as well. It's like an enjoyable little activity, and you don't even have to try to get the benefit. You will just get the benefit from that. Yeah. I'm coming to Willa. There's also a question in the chat, not really a question, but if anyone has good resources on sense restraint, they could link. That would be amazing. Okay. You've got the gradual training there. I've got quite a lot of talks on that as well. I've got one called Calming and Cooling the Senses, I think, somewhere on our YouTube channel. And other talks on the gradual training as well on the Anukampa YouTube channel. Might give another retreat on sense restraint because it's a very rich aspect of practice, very rich. Okay, coming to Willa.
Hi, thank you so much for this space. I really enjoy it. You know, just like I can feel the vibration of silence here. So thank you. And I enjoy this sutta that we read today. And I realized that I inspired my mother for the practice.
Oh.
I wasn't realizing that, but you know, as everybody was sharing, I just realized that she really wanted to read more about that, or like she was enjoying to listen to me, and I wasn't realizing that before. So I recall that I don't remember where it came from, but there was a piece about the Buddha saying that we can repay the debt of gratitude to our parents by introducing them to the practice, something like that.
So
I would just appreciate if you could talk a bit about that. So I could, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. It's very pertinent at the time, actually. We have a guest here who lost a parent recently. My own dad is really sick, and unfortunately his leukemia is progressing quite a lot. And one of the things that comes to mind, especially when our parents are aging, is kind of our gratitude for them, you know, to reflect on what they've done for us. And even if they weren't perfect, all the ways that they did try to keep us safe, keep us fed, and that rouses a sense of gratitude. And then the Buddha says it's difficult to repay that sort of debt of gratitude. He says, unless you carry them both on your shoulders for a long distance or something. I guess that's if they can't walk. But unless, the way you can do it is to bring them closer to the Dhamma. Of course, if you can really get them close to the Dhamma, wonderful. But a lot of that depends on their own readiness, let's say. But sometimes I do reflect on that. I reflect on having the fact that I was quite determined, let's say, you could say rebellious and obstinate, to leave England, travel to India at a young age, and pursue a very different lifestyle, even though they didn't want me to do that, of course. I mean, they didn't exactly say that. But I stuck to my path because I knew there's some meaning, there's some deep meaning for my life here, and this is a calling, this is something I need to pursue. It makes the most sense to me. And because I did that, stuck with that over many, many years, they came on board. And because of that, they traveled to Asia. They actually met some of my teachers. And I remember the first time they meditated in the monastery where I ordained in Burma. I just couldn't stop sort of looking behind myself from time to time. Oh, they're meditating. Ah! I was so excited. And it's just given me so much joy. It's brought us closer together. And whatever they might do with that, whatever that means for their future, I don't know. But I've done what I can, and it's beautiful. It's wonderful. So if you can reflect on that, it's going to bring a lot of joy, and it's going to help you to probably even, benefit them even more.
Oh.
Yeah.
As I'm listening, I've just realized, today I was thinking that I am grateful for her for, you know, that kind of pain or like heart that I had to come through. And today I have a lot of other people recognize some spaciousness or maturity in me. And right now, as you were talking, I realized that like what they acknowledge in me is actually like it's her merit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, she's like Dhamma, like walking through me. And
yes.
Wow, thank you for that.
Oh, that's beautiful. And just to contextualize it a bit further for you is that that's actually part of what we call right view in the Dhamma in Buddhism. One of the reflections we're meant to make in the beginning when we're just starting, really, before we're like, you know, actually seen deeply into right view, is that there is mother, there is father. In other words, there are people that have brought us into this world and they've given us a lot of the qualities we have. And we now have maybe the opportunity or the responsibility to some extent to develop our own qualities, but also a lot of those qualities have been inherited in a sense. We've got a blueprint, right? A genetic blueprint. So yeah, there are many ways that most of us, I don't say all of us, have been raised that are very beneficial. I mean, one way for me is like a love of nature that I inherited from my parents. You know, I'll send my mom pictures of trees and she'll send me videos of the garden, and it's just unbelievable. I mean, the care and the love that she's put into that. It's just completely a different league from what I understand about plants and trees. So yeah, that's lovely to just reflect on that. And then to really value this life as something incredibly precious that's worth really nurturing and taking care of. Because it's a gift. It's a gift. Okay, we have another comment in the chat. I am going to read one more passage in this before we leave, because I promised to one of the guests, and it's another reflection that you might consider. But yes, one more comment in the chat. Today, David Attenborough is being celebrated in the news on his 100th birthday. Wow. This has brought me joy, as he's done so much for the planet and for wildlife. Absolutely amazing. I hope he receives a ton of messages, because I know that sometimes he might feel quite pessimistic about, you know, the amount of climate destruction that's happened in his life. But absolutely, without him, maybe there'd be more. And he certainly engendered a love of nature, fascination with it, and a lot of education for so many people. So, yeah. Sir David Attenborough, isn't it? So he's considered a national treasure, I do believe. It's amazing that he's 100, because I think he's been quite weak and, you know, pretty frail for a long time. But maybe that's a result of a life well lived, you know. You give a lot to the world, to the nature, to other beings, and there's a certain joy and passion there that keeps you going, keeps you alive. He's very positive about future and the work on climate sustainability. Excellent. Yeah, he keeps a positive mind. That's wonderful. Yeah. Good. We have to remain positive. I mean, if we don't have any hope for anything, we won't act, will we? And this is part of what I want to talk about as well on Monday, I think it is. It's important to keep that hope alive. Yeah. And hope and encouragement. And again, related to recollecting our virtue, it's to encourage us, to keep us hopey, right? It gives us energy to continue. So don't be down on yourself. All right, one more. This is yet another recollection, and this is one that I doubt many people do. Okay, how many people recollect the devas? The devas are the heavenly beings, the people that live in the heavenly realms. Joseph, Richard, Shirley, yeah. Benjamin-ish, yeah? Or maybe that was just a very strong wave. It looked like an ish wave, but I'm not quite sure. Okay, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. I do it sometimes, not that much, but in the past I've done it more because my teacher asked me to. And it was very obvious there were lots of devas around. So that was in Myanmar. Okay. So this is the next one. The mind, it says defiled mind, but I'll just say the mind with greed, hate and delusion, Visakha, is cleansed by exertion. And how is it cleansed by exertion? So this is the fifth now. Here, Visakha, a noble disciple recollects the deities thus. There are devas, ruled by the four great kings. These are different categories of devas, okay? So this is the kind of Buddhist cosmology from the Buddha's time. Tarvatimsa devas, Yama devas, Tusita devas, and these are higher and higher beings. So Tusita devas are the devas who are happily content. Then there are the devas who delight in creation. And then there are devas who control what is created by others, and that's even higher still. And guess who lives there? Mara. Isn't that weird? Mara, the one who has control and wields power over other people's creations. Maybe the others in that realm aren't too bad, but Mara has really gone to the extreme of control freak antics. So Mara wants to control us by keeping us stuck in samsara. Then there are devas of Brahma's company, so Brahmakayika devas, that's higher still, and devas that are still higher than these. And then one recollects thus, I too have such faith as those deities, possessed because of which, when they passed away from here, they were reborn there. I too have such virtuous behaviour as those deities, such learning, such generosity, such wisdom as those deities, possessed because of which, when they passed away here, they were reborn there. So we're not just recollecting their qualities and thinking, oh my goodness, they're so much better than me. In fact, not at all. We're not even thinking, wow, you know, they kind of, I have to ask them favours, or I have to kind of get on their good side. Instead, we're thinking, you know what? They're virtuous, but so am I. They have learning, I also have that learning. They are generous, I also have generosity. They might have wisdom, I also have wisdom. And the wisdom and generosity and learning and virtue that enable them to be reborn in the Deva realm. When a noble disciple recollects the faith, virtuous behaviour, learning, generosity and wisdom in oneself and in those Devas, their mind becomes placid, joy arises, and the defilements are abandoned in the same way that impure gold is cleansed by exertion. So we're including ourselves in this again. So maybe this is a natural extension from recollecting our own virtue, that this kind of virtue and our other qualities too, faith, generosity, wisdom, learning, can lead us to a very good rebirth, just like the devas. So to some extent, this maybe requires a little bit of a openness to the fact that these things, these beings can exist, right? May exist. Because some of us don't really believe in invisible beings that we can't see and that we really don't know whether they're there. But maybe there are realms that are kind of correlated to these qualities. How do you feel when you're generous and virtuous? You feel a sense of peace, a sense of happiness. That suggests that if you continue that way, then that sense of peace, that sense of happiness will continue to your next life. It will just continue because the mind is like a stream of consciousness. It's not one thing, but it's a process of arising and passing away. And if this moment is full of virtue, it's very, very likely that the next mind moment will also be carrying those qualities, so to speak. So I like that it includes ourselves in that. I actually had forgotten that part of it and thought it was just about recollecting the devas, but it's recollecting that we are also practicing those qualities. Remember, these devas are not enlightened. They're not necessarily that different from us. So at least if we don't get something higher like stream winning or other attainments on the path, we could be reborn in a very beautiful place where there's a lot of happiness, much more happiness than there is suffering, very, very little suffering. And yet, of course, the Buddha's saying don't aspire to that if there's a chance that you can go further. Don't kind of stop there, right? Don't stop there. And then there is a little example. And how, Visakha, is impure gold cleansed by exertion? By means of a furnace, salt, red chalk, a blowpipe and tongs, and the appropriate effort by the person. I bet no one guessed that that was how you cleanse gold. It is in such a way that impure gold is cleansed by exertion, and so too the defiled mind is cleansed. Here one recollects the deities. There are all these kind of deities in different places who, due to their, what was it? Let me have a look. Uh, basically they had lots of virtue, learning, generosity and wisdom, that because of that, when they passed away from here, they were reborn there. And I too have the same. And then our mind becomes very, very happy. Okay. So let's see. Are we actually in the Deva realm in a sense when we practice these qualities rather than aspiring to be reborn there in the future? I don't think it has to be an either or. It may well be that sometimes when we have a lot of these qualities in our mind, it's as though we're in the Deva realms. It may be that a lot of the time we're living as though in the Deva realms these days because, yeah, there's suffering, but a lot of us have a lot of comfort, right? And a sense of ease a lot of the time. So in a sense, but I think the idea is that if you consider that there is rebirth, it can be inspiring to know that you're headed in a good direction and there's nothing to fear after death. I think that's the point, you know, that we actually can start to feel really confident in our practice, knowing that it's leading somewhere good. We don't have to aspire to be reborn there. I don't think it actually says that. It just says that we recollect that we have those qualities in ourselves and the mind becomes placid, joy arises and the defilements are abandoned. So it's always looking at immediate results, I would say, as a measure of whether a practice works. But the fact is that we are developing qualities that are similar to the Devas, and therefore you can feel happy that, you know, if you don't get stream winning in this life, at least you'll get a good rebirth. If you prefer, you can come back to the human realm, you know, it doesn't matter. But there are cases in the suttas where people said to the Buddha, can we actually kind of try to be reborn in these places? And he said, yeah, if you have the right karma and if you make the aspiration, then it's possible you can. So, but I would say to anyone here, unless you're on your deathbed, even if you are, just keep practicing and keep in sight the idea of understanding non-self, and then you might get in some genuine insight at the time of death. And you don't know, you might already be on the path to stream winning. That is very hard to say. It's very, very hard even for a teacher to say for sure about another person. So, and if you are already on the path, then you must become a stream winner in this life or at the time of death. So the Buddha once kind of actually criticized, I think, Sariputta or one of his chief disciples for encouraging someone who was dying to go to the Deva realm when they could have gone higher, or was it the Brahma realm, but they could have actually got stream winning at that time with a slightly deeper teaching. So, but the point is to get inspiration at this point. Okay. How are we going? We've got 5 minutes left. It's a bit short, isn't it? But it's really beautiful, the next part, because it's actually reflecting on the arahats and reflecting that the way that the arahats live is the way that we are living as well on the Upasata day in regards to our sila. So I'll just do a very, very brief overview of this, because in about 2 minutes flat, okay. So the next recollection is that as long as they live, the arahats, that is the fully enlightened beings, abandon and abstain from the destruction of life, with rod and weapon laid aside, conscientious and kindly, they dwell compassionate towards all living beings. Today, for this night and day, that's the Upasata night and day, I too shall abandon and abstain from the destruction of life, with the same passage repeated. I shall imitate the arahats in this respect, and the Upasata will be observed by me. And then also, as long as they live, the arahats abandon and abstain from taking what is not given. And please read this because it's beautiful. I won't have time to read through the whole thing. I shall imitate the arahats in this respect, and the Upasata will be observed by me. They abstain from sexual activity and observe celibacy, living apart. I too shall imitate the arahats in this respect. They abandon and abstain from false speech and speak the truth. I too shall imitate the arahats in this respect. This is nice, isn't it? Because it's a bit like the Saleka Sutta, but that's like, they will be cruel, I will not be cruel. But here it's like the arahats do this, I will also do this. So it's a bit similar, but in the positive aspect. The arahats abstain from liquor, wine, and intoxicants. I too shall do the same. The arahats eat once a day. For this night and day, I too shall eat once a day. So this is the eight precepts now that we observe on the Aposta days. They abstain from dancing, singing, instrumental music, on suitable shows, adorning and beautifying themselves by wearing garlands and applying scents and unguents. I too shall abstain from these things, just like the arahats. They also abstain from the use of high and luxurious beds. They lie down on a simple bed, let's say. I too shall imitate the arahats, and the Aposta will be observed by me. When one has observed the Aposta in the way of the noble ones, it's of great fruit and benefit, extraordinarily brilliant and pervasive. So there we go. We will end there. So take inspiration that whenever you observe sila, whenever you observe virtuous conduct, and some of you are doing this for more than a night and a day, some of you are always abstaining from killing, always abstaining from stealing, always abstaining from sexual misconduct. You're living like the arahats live. Isn't that amazing? The difference is perhaps that we haven't seen through the delusion of a self, but our virtue is really, really strong. So you too can become one of the arahats by practicing the path. Okay, last question. What is considered an Aposta day? Is it only full moon or a new moon, or are the half moon days also included? It's all four. So it's every... Oh, is it? No, it's not all four. You could do it for all four, but it's basically just the full moon and the new moon. So it's twice a month. And they're the days that the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis chant the Patimokkha as well. So yeah, full moon and new moon. So, but if that's not convenient for you, just do any 2 days in the month. See if you can maybe abstain from eating after 12 and all the other things like the music, the entertainment, the makeup, the jewellery. Try and do it. I've recently had to kill ants and it's been really upsetting. How might I forgive yourself? That's how. That's what you need to do. Yeah. Sometimes we have to cause some harm. I mean, or we feel in a position where we don't see another choice. And sometimes we don't know we're doing it, right? Sometimes you can be, I don't know, trying to make an ethical choice around the food you eat. But, you know, creatures are going to get killed in the plough. It's a fact of life. So forgive yourself. I mean, obviously, we try not to kill ants. And if you're upset, that's a good sign. You're not a heartless sociopath, which I know. So remember how it feels and see if you can make every attempt not to do it again. But you have to forgive yourself. Yeah, send metta to those little creatures. And yeah, make sure you get a good rebirth, you know. You don't want to be reborn as an ant. And you won't. You won't. It's not related to that. It's just that, you know, we have to send them metta. Okay, so Manoi, would you like to close up for us?
Yeah, so from sila to generosity. So taking this opportunity to tell a few words on generosity and helping us to develop wholesome qualities that form the foundation of our Dhamma practice. So as usual, I just wanted to remind you that at Anukampa, we offer several ways that we can cultivate this beautiful quality of chaga or generosity. One thing, the simplest thing is the one-time donation of any amount where you can donate through our website, through a bank transfer or through PayPal or SumUp. If you're financially able, you can do a regular donation. And offering your time, if you are capable, if you have any specialty and time, is also valuable. If you want to get involved as a volunteer, please contact team@anukampaproject.org. Sorry, the link will be there in the chat soon. And then offering meals to the monastics, go there and at the dana time, contact him. In the Anukampa website, there is a calendar. So book a time and go there if you can. You'll be able to talk to the monastics as well. And if you are unable to go there, if you live far away, you can do it remotely. You can send things remotely. You can do a supermarket delivery. You can find needed items. There are so many ways to get involved. Thank you very much for being this community.
Thank you, Manoa. Yeah, it's so wonderful to have everybody here as part of the community, really. It's a blessing. And actually, at the moment, we don't have many Dana guests. So we really are living on your generosity, like on your shopping that comes and the vegetable boxes. And yeah, it's there's always scope for more people to be involved in that way. And what is coming up? Lots and lots of teachings. I've got an online teaching on Sunday morning, which is going to be translated bit by bit into Vietnamese, but you're all welcome to join. The teaching link is on the website, and then the one for Sydney on Monday morning. And what else? What's the next one? Poland on the following Saturday or Sunday, I think the 16th possibly. And then something else for BuddhaNet or something like that on the 20th, because it was meant to be with Bente Sajato, but he's gone completely silent and hasn't answered, and I don't know what's happening. So the first talk, I've said, well, it's too late now because he hasn't answered. He was supposed to lead it and I was supposed to join him. But anyway, they've asked me to lead the second one. So that'll be my gig. He may or may not turn up. I've no idea. But that will be probably on the Buddha's loving kindness that he expressed through creating inclusive communities, how he was inclusive, because it's about the Buddha for Vaisak. What else? We've got Ajahn Brahmani coming to England, and there's still space at his public talk. Please come if you possibly can, because not many people come to the talks anymore. Maybe the price of petrol or train, maybe you're actually overseas. And then there's a day retreat as well. And what else? I'm looking at you, but you're not giving me anything.
There is another talk in London.
Oh, yeah, there is another talk in London as well. That's right. And it's not publicised yet. And that's at London Buddhist Vihara on the 22nd of June, I do believe. So that's really easy. It's in Chiswick for any Londoners. Okay. So the Dhamma talk on the 14th isn't going to take place. You have to ask Bante Sajato because we talked about it 2 months ago. We haven't heard from him yet since, and we've sent about 20 emails. So, yeah, no one can get him to answer. So, I don't speak for him. You can try and show up and see what happens, but yeah, it's been quite tricky. So, all right, everybody, I'm going to leave you there. If you're not coming to any of those things, I'll be back on Wednesday with the chanting, and next Friday, I'm not sure if there's a sutta or not. Possibly not, because of all the other teachings I'm doing. But I think I do have a metta meditation next Saturday. Not this Saturday, but next Saturday. Okay. Take care, everybody. And by the way, I saw the question about the ants again. Just leave them. Leave them be. They're fine. They come and they go. Honestly, they'll walk out again eventually. If you can sort of somehow live with them. Turmeric also helps, though. But it doesn't. It might work, but it might not, and it might also stain your floor bright yellow. So, but I've lived with ants in Burma. I've had whole streams of them this wide across the wall. I mean, it's shocking. You come into a white room and you see this black band that's moving across the wall, okay? And I just had to wait. And they went under my tatami mat that I would sleep on, and they were under there as well. I mean, it was kind of freaky. They all had eggs as well. And I couldn't rest or anything. But I just had to wait, and after about 2 days, they'd all gone. They'd left from the bed by nighttime, phew. And then by a couple of days, they passed through because they were just seasonal. I don't know. Maybe they were laying eggs in, well, I don't know. But see if you can, you know, live with them for a while and see what happens. Yeah. All right. Take care, everyone. You can unmute now and wave goodbye. It'll be lovely to hear your voices. And if anyone from here wants to come and wave goodbye, you're welcome to. They like to see people. Come. Come. There's one of the cozy corner people.